Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Eric Tonesmeyer, author of numerous books and articles on permaculture, including the much-lauded Edible Forest Gardens with Dave Jackie. He joins us to talk about his next book, which he is seeking to support with a crowdfunding campaign via Kickstarter. The book Eric is working on and needs your help with is Toolkit for Climate Stabilization with Tree Crops, which examines perennial solutions to stabilizing and reducing the impacts of climate change and to help bolster a reduction of fossil fuels with an eventual transition to a petrochemical-free future. Our conversation, though a bit nerdy at times, expands the thinking on potential yields in a system and how we can creatively respond to change. I find his decision to use crowdfunding as a model fascinating because of how it connects authors and producers with their audience, allowing them to combine efforts to create works of value in a way equitable to everyone involved. Here's the idea of collaboration, not competition, being used in a very horizontal way. Crowdfunding is also used in a different way to help this show. If you go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support, you can make a one-time or recurring monthly donation, as well as find out how to follow the show on Facebook or Twitter. I've also connected with Flatter. If you use that service to make micro-donations, this podcast is now engaged. Lastly, for those Android and iOS smartphone users, check out the Stitcher Radio app, and you can listen to the show wherever you go. Now then, on to the interview with Eric. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates. Since you've joined us on the show before, I don't feel that we need to start with a biography. I can point people to our previous episodes to get that. So why don't you go ahead and let us know a little bit about this new Kickstarter campaign that you're getting off the ground and the book that you're looking to fund with it.
Let's see, the campaign is called Writing the Toolkit for Climate Stabilization with Tree Crops. I'm writing a book, and I want to have the time to be able to really crank this thing out. I've been like squeezing it in between, you know, on the plane, on the way home from my workshops, and at night after my baby goes to bed, and I want to just be able to plow through and do this. I've done half the research already over the last couple years, piecing it together here and there, but I really want to, and some people have probably seen my article on perennial staple crops and the other one on stabilizing the climate with permanent agriculture, which are really what this is just unpacking into a book. It's a manual about the hopeful solution, the contribution that agriculture based on permanent crops can make to the climate crisis, both in terms of reducing emissions, but primarily in terms of actively sequestering carbon and trying to get that atmospheric amount of carbon back down to 350 parts per million or below, which means sucking down 200 to 250 gigatons of carbon, which is, you know, quite a lot, really. So that's the big idea, is it's about how to use permaculture strategies on the global scale as a component of the larger strategies around climate change, which must involve some serious political and economic reorganization and transforming everything about our way of life as people, really. At least in the developed world, we have to completely transform our way of life, and this book is really about that. Some of the strategies and species that I'm looking at are really ready for prime time, and some of them are very much still under development, and I'm trying to give that whole range of strategies and say, well, what can we do in the next 20 years? Let's go for it, and let's attract funding for this. Let's take the climate change money that there is now and that's going to be coming down the pike, and let's put it into transforming the world into a permaculture paradise instead of building giant orbiting solar mirrors and these other kind of like super intense geoengineering strategies that, while we may end up needing them, they don't do anything for the world's poorest people. And there's this idea of climate justice, that the people who caused the climate problem are primarily people in the wealthy countries, but they are suffering the least from it, partly because they tend not to be in the tropics where things are being felt most strongly, and partly because they have more sort of wealth and privilege to fall back on. So we're looking for climate change strategies that address that imbalance. And one way to do that is to fund the permaculturization of the tropical and developing worlds, that which would do much more for your farmer in Guatemala than a giant orbiting solar mirror would in terms of social and economic benefits to the community.
hearing that number of 200 to 250 gigatons, I would feel off if I asked you the question, do you think that it's possible for us to sequester that? Because obviously this is your work and you think that we can. I'm just wondering, what would it take and what would it look like to get that much carbon out of the air with plants? Do you see them as being like a particular percentage to go along with these different ideas?
You can't do it all with farming. There's just not enough land to sequester all that carbon in the soil and in plants, but you can do an awful lot. It really depends on how massively you could implement this scale. And the numbers on how much carbon you can sequester with, let's say, agroforestry practices vary enormously. They can be as low as 9 tons per hectare over the lifetime of a field, like over the until the trees get to full size, let's say, and as high as 228. So that's a massive range, and there's a lot of variables in there. You can sequester more carbon in cold climates than in warm climates because the organic matter stays longer in the soil. You can sequester more where there's more water, more humidity, because there's more plant growth. Certain kinds of plants sequester more than other plants, and certain practices sequester more carbon than others. So those are all variables. I've run some numbers with a very conservative imagining that we were looking at 25 tons per hectare as a global average, which when you look at 9 to 228, 25 is pretty low, right? At that point, if we were to take the world's sloping agricultural land, which is a good percentage of the world's agricultural land is sloping, you could sequester almost 20% of what's needed. And even if you were to do just the most seriously sloping agricultural lands, over 30% slopes, at that 25 tons per hectare amount, you could do something like 3.5 gigatons, which is about how much humanity puts out every year in terms of new carbon that we're dumping out into the atmosphere. So the more perennial the system is, the more carbon it sequesters. It appears that the more diverse a system is, the more carbon it sequesters. And there's lots of non-agricultural land that can be converted to this kind of system as well. So I'm very hopeful that it could do a quarter of the job or even as much as half if we could get everybody to do it, which is, of course, a massive logistical problem with no precedent in all the history of humanity. But we need something that's unprecedented in the history of humanity in order to get through this. So I'm saying this is the best unprecedented option that I see that we have.
I'm reminded of mankind deciding that we were going to go to space and to land on the moon. And that when you look at the amount of effort that was placed into that kind of a project, that moonshot seems to be the reference point that many people are looking at now for how we will wind up facing these issues, that right now, because as you say, with our ability to import food into the global north from wherever we wish to buy it from because of market forces and being able to turn on our air conditioner if it gets a little too heated, that there isn't a need for it yet, that long horizon for the amount of time that it takes to feel climate change as it continues to move north, that we still have another 30 or 50 years before these large portions of the population will encounter that. I'm hopeful that through systems like this that we don't require that kind of a huge, massive effort in a short period of time to make a change, that these ideas will spread and we can begin to tackle them, well, as we should have. When's the best time to plant a tree? 10 years ago.
Right.
The next best time to plant a tree is today. So that's really where we're at, is that to make those choices and options today.
Well, the nice thing about this particular set of strategies is that they're a good idea even if there was no climate change. Permaculture is a great idea. Stabilizing slopes is a good idea. Breaking the flood and drought cycle is a great idea. Perennial crops are a great idea for their soil building capacity and their decreased labor. There's a huge range of sort of multifunctional social and ecological benefits. And I'm hoping that I can get groups, that we as a movement, you know, can get groups behind this for whom climate change is not their priority, but who have other social and economic priorities that are served by this. So a coalition may stand a better chance of looking at this. Like, there's a great book I have, this series, the Lost Crops of Africa series. For each crop they review, they talk about how can this impact the lives of poor women in rural areas. And then they're trying to really fund their crop breeding efforts and crop development efforts with funds that are coming through for women's education and self-determination. And I think it really is going to take getting a lot of people behind it, not just the climate people, in order to get a strategy like this implemented on a big scale. While the effects we're looking at some of in the cold climates, maybe 30 to 50 years, it looks like the tipping points are within the next 10 to 20 years. We may not feel the effects for a while after that, but the time to act is really, we really just got a couple of decades here. That's not very much time at all. And so I've been looking at different case studies of how things have been addressed, like how people pulled together during World War II, how people responded to the Dust Bowl, the like John Liu's movie about the big arid areas in Western China and how desertification has been stopped by tree planting out there. And some of these very large scale successful efforts, and what is it that we can learn from those?
That really allows a lot of opportunity for a permaculture practitioner or anyone else who's interested in these ideas to use that systems thinking, broad scale design approach to take these ideas into places that might not normally think about them in a way that doesn't require us to have the climate change conversation. But I think about, as you say this, for the area that I'm in, we deal with daily total load that runs into our streams because of my watershed empties into the Chesapeake Bay. So many of the conversations with farmers is about doing riparian buffers, but then they have to remove so many acres of, out of production to build a good one. So how can we use these kinds of ideas then to approach them? Well, this is how you can build a riparian buffer that will have value to you economically. In the back, be able to check off, hey, this is also going to help climate change.
I feel like the perennial systems that are up and running and ready to go do sell themselves pretty well, or can sell themselves pretty well. But in terms of developing new perennial crops, that takes a bunch of, that takes some research dollars and stuff, you know, to get the Land Institute's work with perennial grains up and running is a big and expensive project, for example. Whereas there's some really nice work being done on productive riparian buffers in Vermont and New York State right now. And you can grow so many great, the soil's great down there and there's plenty of moisture. And I've been learning more about the sort of categories of perennial crops, not just the food crops. Willow biomass would grow extremely well in a riparian area, and you can coppice that and do a million different things with it. So I think I'm not imagining that we're purging annuals from the world. I love annuals, but I think there's responsible ways to grow them, and typically that's going to involve perennial buffers and perennial contour plantings and so on. And there's a certain amount of steepness that just is appropriate to grow annuals on no matter what, unless you're a terraced or something.
As so often happens in these interviews, I know that we could go down this road for quite some time discussing the solutions and other pieces, but because I have you here to discuss the book and your campaign, I'd like to move back to that for a few minutes.
Sure.
Because this is being handled through Kickstarter, and there are usually goals and stretch goals and donor rewards and things associated with that, what is your goal at this point to raise through the campaign?
Sure. Well, I'm looking at a one-month campaign that I believe is going to end April 20th, and I'm looking for $20,000. I ran a bunch of numbers, and by the time you pay back people's rewards and give Kickstarter their percent and so on, that's what it's going to take for me to have the number of months, the 21 months that I think I need in order to write this book properly. That's enough to give me money to live on that I can at least write 2 weeks out of every month. So that's sort of my personal selfish goal for it, is to have enough money to be able to do this. And I'm pretty enthusiastic. I feel like I've been getting some good response from people when I've been talking about it. And I've taken this book so many places. I tried to get a fellowship and I was shot down. I looked into a PhD program and they weren't interested in having me for that. I pitched it to some big magazines and they didn't want anything to do it. And I even got an agent who went around and talked to different publishers for me, most of whom weren't interested at all. And the few who were said, well, that's very lovely. The world needs that book, but we can't give you, you know, more than a $5,000 advance for that, which it just does not give me 21 months of writing time. And I feel like I'm I'm ready to kick butt on this thing. I've gotten a bunch of the research done, and it's just so incredibly exciting and so interesting. I feel like I'm really ready to share it with the world, and I think the world's ready for the book too.
With 21 months to write this, I'm sitting here looking at my two-book copy of Edible Forest Gardens, thinking about that kind of a tome and knowing how long it took you to write that.
Oh, thank God it's not going to be like that.
So this will be something that 21 months should surely see you wrap up the book and be able to get it out into the world within a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, that's my sense. I learned a lot from writing Edible Forest Gardens. And one of the things I learned is, well, don't write a 1,000-page book. That takes 9 years. But what I really learned is that for me to write a book and do it in a reasonable amount of time, I need to have a very specific focus of what the book is about, a very specific set of guiding questions. And anything that doesn't fit that is out, like perennial vegetables. Book about perennial vegetables. I thought, oh, should I do a chapter on perennial grains? No, this is a chapter on perennial vegetables. And that's like a design constraint. You know, I create a very specific constraint. I clarify my goals, and then I lay out the book and I try and keep it as tight as possible. This Paradise Lot book I was able to do in about a year of writing. Perennial vegetables was about a year of writing. So I feel like if I give myself almost 2 years for this one, given that I've done as much as I have already, that gives me some slack time for the things that life throws at you, which it does. When I was writing perennial vegetable, writing Paradise Lot, I had surgery and I lost 3 months, you know, and I had a baby, which was planned, but it eats up some time. And I think I have a pretty good sense of how long these things take to do. And I pretty much know what goes in this book. It's mostly a matter of writing it, you know, getting it on paper in a nice way, and fleshing out a little bit more of the research on particular topics that I'm not sharp enough on yet.
Well, and I imagine finding the right resources to fill out that kind of research, given what does and doesn't exist relative to the mainstream material that's available versus all of the journal articles and everything else that can be hard to dig through, even with all the searches that are available and the help of those lovely reference librarians. Looking at this, how many pages are you expecting this book to be when you're done?
I'm thinking about 300 pages, which would bring it in shorter than even the first volume of Edible Forest Gardens. Okay. Just sort of like an extra chapter or two tacked on to perennial vegetables in terms of length, which is challenging because I'm finding each chapter I'm working on this could be unpacked into a whole book. And I'm doing my very best to just limit and limit and limit that. The idea of this book is not to tell you how to run a farm like this, but is to take to the general public and policymakers, and certainly to interested permaculture folks who want to do application, to say, here's the basic idea of this solution, and here is the toolkit. These are the practices, and these are the species that we have to work with. And then there's a little piece on the end about implementation, which I'm no expert on. So I'm just sort of laying out, these are some of the basic concepts. These are some of the barriers, and these are some of the models, and these are some of the strategies that I would suggest for implementing this at this kind of a scale. So I'm trying to be a really good boy and not include 10,000 pages of species lists. I'm going to have to make a whole website for that because I can't resist making them, but I know they don't belong in the book. I'm trying to write something that will sort of blow people's minds with the possibilities of what's already out there and what could be out there with a little bit of time and money thrown at it.
In avoiding those long tables, you might have an appendix with a couple of pages to give some folks some numbers to support this, but not to go and create just a second book with all that material in it.
Absolutely. It's not a book about climate change. It's not a book about plant breeding. It's not a book about what's wrong with our agricultural system today. It's really a book about a subset of strategies for climate change and other problems. And mostly looking at the pieces, the toolkit that we have to work with in terms of some of these practices, from rotational grazing to tree crops to agroforestry. And then looking at the perennial staple crops themselves, which are incredibly interesting and exciting, and at some of the industrial crops as well that I'm just really having my mind blown by. I'm having a tremendous amount of fun with that, and I just never thought about those things before.
I would like to talk with you about the industrial plants, because that was something that caught my attention when we were setting up this interview. But real quick, let's finish up the pieces of the Kickstarter campaign. Your goal is $20,000. Do you have any stretch goals? Should you head past that?
If I can get past that, the more I get, the sooner the book comes out. And should there be way more than that, which I would be totally happy with, that would enable me to travel to visit sites. I'd like to get to the Land Institute very much. There's some people doing incredible work on domesticating the mesquite tree as a food crop in Bolivia. That would be really interesting to see. I'd love to see some of the really interesting agroforestry projects around the world in the tropics. There's a lot of really cool stuff happening. So were I to get more than $20,000, I think I could just make it an awesomer book and make it come out sooner. And if I don't make $20,000 and the Kickstarter thing shuts down and we go back to zero, I'm still going to find a way to get this information out there one way or the other. I've already plowed my way through 5 defeats, and I am prepared to just keep on going and doing whatever I can. But I feel like people are pretty excited about this idea when I go around and talk about it. I think we may really have the momentum to get to 20 or beyond.
And I'll do my part to help make that happen. So we can get this out here in more hands so people know what you're working on. And at what level would someone need to donate to receive a copy of the book? What are the donor rewards as part of this campaign?
Sure. Well, I tried to put a few really low price ones on. So for $10, I have a compilation of all my articles that I've written in the last 13 years. That's the minimum one. Then I've got I put together a small number. I'll do 30 of these. A book just at cost, $22 signed book. I'm estimating that the book is going to cost $40 because I want to have some color photos in there. So for $22, people will be able to get the book just at cost, just what it costs me to buy it in from the printer and put it in an envelope and send it out. There'll be 30 of those. Typically, the books are going to go for $40, so I'm hoping to see a bunch of people buy signed copies of the book for $40, or you can get 2 copies for $80. And I think mostly people, it's like a CSA, right? You pre-buy a book, and then when it comes out, you get it. And I think one of the things people know about me is that I write a lot of books. You know, I've seen ranking them out. I had a DN out last year. I've had chapters in a couple other books lately. I had the other 2 books. I seem to be able to crank them out, and I would love to have an ongoing relationship with readers where they sort of pre-buy these things, and that enables me to not mess around with having to do a bunch of consulting and stuff, but be able to just cut right in there and do what I do, which is write these books. Okay, so then after that, we've got, this one is really exciting, for $150. You get the book, of course, but then I'm putting together a perennial staple crop sampler. So these will be foods, perennial staple crops most of us have never eaten. I'll be, you know, getting a bunch of them in bulk, packaging them up and sending them out to people. So you'll get a bunch of different things to play around with and some recipes for how to cook them, like mesquite meal. And I have a really nice recipe for mesquite pancakes, and I have another nice recipe for mesquite cornbread and so on. And so there'll be some fun things to try there. I'm excited about that one. For pricier ones, I have for $500, I have a half hour phone consult, and then I'll put together a custom species list. Then for $1,000, people don't usually get a whole lot of these, but you might as well put them in, and somebody might want to do this. You get the phone consult and species list, plus I'll plant 3 staple crop trees in 3 different climates with nice name tags dedicating them to you in various places around the world. So that's the set of rewards that I've put together. Mostly I'm thinking people are going to do the books. I'm hoping some people want to try the staple crop sampler. I'm excited about that. I'm excited to try some of these things. I've never had sago starch, and I've eaten probably more of these things than a lot of people, but I'm yet to sample a lot of these things for the first time, so I'm enthusiastic about that.
I'm interested in those mesquite pancakes. That's pancakes and bacon are one of my killer foods, and we have great local bacon. So I'll have to look for that recipe.
And eventually that should be acorn fattened hogs and mesquite pancakes, and then you're really talking.
I don't know that I'd be talking after a meal like that. I just, just the sounds of joy and the mumbles as I slide out of the chair. I grew up in a family that did a lot of eating together. And it's only as I get further into middle age that I realize how quickly that can catch up with you. But, oh, do I still love it. Moving from food, what about some of these industrial crops that you're researching, these perennial industrial crops?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting area that I had never really given a lot of thought before. I didn't even really quite know what industrial crops are or why they're important. And we're really looking at three categories of industrial crops. There's materials, chemicals, and energy. And some of the industrial crops that we use every day would be cotton and rubber. Many of us in the organic farming world would use biopesticides like pyrethrum, or pyganic would be the commercial version of that. And anybody who's ever used firewood has used an industrial crop in that sense of it. And really, as long as there's been agriculture, there's been industrial crops. A lot of archaeologists now believe that when agriculture developed in the coast of Chile, way back thousands and thousands of years ago, the first crop they domesticated was cotton to use in making fishing nets so they could catch their food. So that's a case where agriculture was first developed for the purposes of industrial products and not for food at all. So some of these things go way back. The problem is that a lot of these plants are annuals. In fact, probably the biggest industrial crop right now is GMO corn, which we use to make almost everything these days. Or they are destructively harvested perennials like pine trees or spruce trees that are cut down to make paper and cardboard. Many of these products are synthesized from petroleum. And that's partly where I think we can really step into the gap. Dealing with carbon emissions is not just about reducing our use of petroleum for fuel, but also our use of petroleum for plastic and the 50,000 other things we make from petroleum, including most of our fibers, most of our rubber, almost all of our plastic are made out of petroleum. So we need to figure out how to replace that. And the few perennial industrial crops that we have, like sugarcane, oil palm, and rubber, are being grown on these enormous monocultures that have devastating social and ecological consequences. Industrial crops seem to be particularly prone to atrocity. We could look at cotton being used as the sort of material excuse for slavery in the United States. We can look at actually sugarcane today in Brazil. People are being convicted for slavery for their treatment of their workers on sugarcane plantations for ethanol in Brazil, you know, in this decade. Rubber has been devastating both in the Americas and throughout the world. There's been all kinds of atrocities in the name of rubber. So particularly with industrial crops, we need to pay attention to the social and ecological issues. And the front that's happening on right now the most is around bioenergy, where the oil palm plantations and this sugarcane issues are very serious problems socially and environmentally. They're leading to these great big land grabs in Africa, where huge companies and countries are buying up big pieces of land, essentially throwing out the people who work there and using them to make these agrofuels. And I'm not opposed to biofuel at all. I think bio-based fuels are great, but we can't meet the planet's current energy needs with biofuels and also have food and habitat that just takes a lot of land to do that. So my thought is that most of our energy needs should come from solar, wind, and water, and that we still, of course, people are going to use firewood and we're going to need some liquid fuels. You can't fly a plane on batteries and you can't run a heavy excavator on batteries and stuff. So we need some biofuels. But more importantly, you can't make plastic from the wind. You can't make rubber from the wind. These are real things we need as a civilization that must come from plants, because it's really not okay for them to come from petroleum anymore. So I'm looking at what are the materials and energy and chemicals, particularly materials and chemicals, but also energy, that we can get from non-destructively harvested perennial crops, meaning plants that will grow for many years that can be harvested multiple times that provide these yields. And I've got some categories of that I could run through just to give an idea of what are the types of plants and what are the types of products that we make or can make from these things.
That was going to be my next question, was if you could give us some examples of those. So if you'd like to go ahead and lead into that.
Great. And please excuse me for sounding like a super nerd on this, but I can't tell you how much I just personally enjoy this. The first broadest category is biomass. And the types of crops with that would be resprouting woody plants, like coppiced woody plants. At this point, a lot of that is happening with like willows and poplars would be some examples up here. Alders would be another nice example in cold climates. People are working a lot with giant grasses, like giant miscanthus and arundodonax and some other giant grasses. Bamboo is a phenomenal biomass producer. And then there are some crop residues, like when you're growing hazelnuts, you get hazelnut husks and shells, which are an excellent biomass product. For materials, we make paper out of biomass, and we certainly could make it out of more sustainable sources than we do now, paper and cardboard. There's a category called agromaterials, which are these sort of aggregates made out of pulped up biomass, like pulped up willows or sunflower seed husks and stuff like that. You can make all these interesting materials. Insulation, green building materials, synthetic fibers, and biochar certainly would be an excellent material that can be made out of biomass. Then we've got some chemicals that are made out of them, all kinds of solvents. And this concept of chemical feedstocks has been really interesting to me. There are these raw materials, raw chemicals, basic simple chemicals that are used as the basis of the chemical industry. And I've been learning about the green movement within chemistry. Right now, they're basic, what they call platform chemicals that they use to make everything else that they make from petroleum. But there's a set of platform chemicals that you can make from plants that can be used, like lactic acid is one, acetic acid is one, that can be used to make an almost infinite array of products. And some of these can be made from biomass. Some come from the other categories of industrial crops. But we're looking at, how do you make a non-toxic, renewable, bio-based chemical industry? That's an interesting set of questions. And then for energy, there's a lot of kinds of energy from biomass. We have firewood and other kinds of, they make these sort of compressed different kinds of combustible materials, like pellets. Those wood pellets would be one that a lot of us know for wood stoves. Biogas, and the advantage of biogas compared to almost any other kind of energy source is that while you're taking the carbon and hydrogen out by turning it into methane and getting it in a burnable form, you're leaving a lot of those other chemicals and biomass in place. What's the fermentation substrate that's left behind can then be spread back out onto the fields, and that helps to cycle phosphorus and calcium and other nutrients like that. You're losing less of those nutrients this way. There's pyrolysis and gasification, which is how we make biochar, and you can generate energy from that. Certainly ethanol, and then methanol, which they're working on ways to make methanol out of wood biomass. The challenge with some of these techniques, both in the chemical and energy categories, is that they're really looking at genetically engineering the crops or the fermenting bacteria. And I'm not a fan of genetic engineering, not only because it's creepy, and not only because it's dangerous in terms of escaping into the environment, but more importantly for me, because genetic engineering it's a high-tech, incredibly expensive strategy, and it helps to further the consolidation of the ownership of plant genetic resources in the hands of the few very giant life science companies. And I'm primarily interested in the kinds of industrial crops and processes and products that can be done on a decentralized, low-tech kind of a strategy, and that can be based in polyculture production. So that's the biomass category. They'll be shorter after this. Any thoughts on that one before I move into a couple more of these?
My only comment was about that decentralization goes back to your idea earlier that it gets these materials and these ideas in the hands of people who might not have access to them otherwise, as opposed to, again, that idea of the global north. We have money and all these resources we can buy or contract for just about anything we want, but by decentralizing it, it allows many different people access to these products.
Yeah, and I feel like right now the raw materials are being grown in the, let's say mostly in the tropics, right, in the developing world, and then shipped here for processing, and then we send the final product back and sell it to them. Really, we can't be globally shipping things around anymore if we want to reduce emissions. Every region has to produce most of its own food and its own plastic and its own energy and its own paper and so on. And that's really an interesting challenge, and I think can be used strategically to really help to provide some very sustainable development for some of the global South countries. Okay, moving on to industrial starch, which I didn't even know was a thing until a couple of months ago. Right now, almost all the starch that's used industrially is food starch. It's basically close to 100% food that's being used. For example, 17% of all the grain that's grown in Europe goes to make paper and cardboard. That's quite a lot of food, especially annual food being put into paper making and stuff. So I'm looking at certainly all the perennial carbohydrate crops that people eat could be used for this, but I'm especially interested in non-edible carbohydrates, which would allow us to have greater diversity of crops out on the ground. And more diversity means more stability and better pest control and all that. So some of the fun ones that I'm thinking about for colder climates include the horse chestnuts, which produce pretty well and have poisonous nuts. And even more interesting to me right now is the Osage orange. Do you know that tree?
Yes.
We used to call it brain fruit when I was growing up. You know, those great big green grapefruit looking things, which are very high in starch. And some trees produce really well. So if you had a bunch of grafted female trees with the occasional male in there, I think you could produce, so far my numbers that I've been running look like as much as 9 tons of starch per hectare, which is, you know, about as good as corn would do using inedible starch grown on a tree. And the amount of things that are made or can be made from starch is fascinating. Certainly paper and cardboard are some of the biggest uses. It's also used in drywall and plasterboard as a binder. And it's an essential ingredient in bioplastic. I got this great book recently called Green Plastics, and it has recipes in the back for how to make plastic in your kitchen. I just went out and bought all the ingredients at my local supermarket. Cornstarch, which would be our starch in this case. Glycerin, which is a byproduct of biodiesel production. It's basically a kind of soap, which you can make from plant-based oils. And gelatin, which is made from bones and hooves of animals. So that's some of the building blocks for bio-based compostable plastics. And if you think about how much plastic people use and how useful a product it is and what a nightmare it is now, something like 200 million tons a year of plastic are made worldwide. That's almost all non-biodegradable. So while it's sequestering carbon, I suppose, it's based in petroleum, it's toxic in the production, it's often toxic in the slow breakdown, and it's non-biodegradable. So that all needs to be changed around. Then there's all these chemical uses for starches, as binding and coating and stabilizing all different kinds of products. And often it's used as a fermentation substrate to produce a lot of interesting chemicals and pharmaceuticals. And then, of course, you can make ethanol from starch. And to me, why make ethanol from food starch when you could make it from non-food starches? That just makes more sense to me. Similarly, there are some perennial sugars. Basically, all you're making out of that is ethanol and other solvents. And then we have oils. And again, I'm looking mostly at non-edible oils. I cover edible oils, perennial oils in the book. You need those oils from these perennial oil seeds. You need them for bioplastics. You need them to make glycerin and soaps and all different kinds of industrial lubricants. Like WD-40 is made from fossil fuels. I'm not prepared to live without WD-40. It's a marvelous product. And biodiesel, of course. Now, some of the industrial oils are mostly they're tropical, but there are some interesting candidates for cold climates. The folks at the Land Institute are working on making a perennial sunflower that would make heavy yields of edible seeds. We have some interesting potential with perennial brassicas. And there's a lovely, for folks in the western part of the U.S., the buffalo gourd is a very drought-tolerant, very cold-tolerant edible seed, and that seed is an excellent oil product. So that would be an interesting one for people to use as well. There's certainly tons of fiber plants, and I won't really go into that except to say they're not just for textiles, but also fibers are used in all different kinds of composite materials now, including in both Germany and Brazil. They're building cars with a lot of parts made out of plastic with tons and tons of fibers in there to hold them in place to serve as a stabilizer. But my favorite category of industrial crops are hydrocarbons. And these are plants with long chain hydrocarbons in them, just like fossil fuels, that you can basically use just like fossil fuels. A lot of them are used to make rubber, like rubber trees, and our hardy analog of that would be, well, there is a hardy rubber tree. There's a Chinese rubber tree that's hardy through zone 5, which is very interesting. But the one I'm especially thrilled about is milkweed. That latex, that white sticky stuff that comes out when you break the stem of a milkweed, is rubber or contains rubber. So we can use, we can domesticate milkweed, and there are efforts underway to do this, to be a source of rubber, to be a source of long chain hydrocarbons for chemical feedstocks and for plastics and so on. And at the same time, you get an excellent fiber product out of milkweed. It has two fibers, the floss fiber from the fluffy seeds, and the stem fiber is fantastic. And you can make so many different things. You could make from those kind of hydrocarbons, you can make jet fuel, you can make propane and butane, and you can make gasoline and diesel and all kinds of very interesting things. And it seems to me, again, I don't want to see giant monoculture fields of any of this stuff. I think what they call integrated fuel and agricultural systems, where you have all this stuff working together in a polyculture, is the most sensible. The hydrocarbon plant I'm most excited about is a tropical one called the diesel tree, which you can actually tap, get good amounts of sap out of it. You run the sap through a filter, and then you can put it straight into a diesel engine and run a diesel, whether it's a diesel piece of equipment for food processing or a diesel motor for a vehicle. I think that's really exciting, and that's an example of something that to me is a very low-tech. It's just a tree, and you could plant a grove of them in every village in the humid tropics, and they'd be able to grow their own diesel right there without needing any processing of any kind. And that's the kind of stuff I'm really excited about. There's also the soap nut tree that there are very hardy versions and very tropical versions of. And you can take the fruit, put it in a sock, throw it in the washing machine, and it serves as your laundry soap. So the more moringa seed is another one that you can use to purify water in very rural areas in the tropics. So I'm most interested in those kind of low-tech applications, but I'm not opposed in principle to the idea of some of these higher-tech applications, up to and including the biorefinery, which makes 1,000 products out of some of these kinds of bio-based materials. What people are promoting for biorefineries is just using corn or other mono feedstocks, especially annual feedstocks, which I'm totally not interested in. But could there potentially be a biorefinery that could be serving the needs of a democratic society with an equitable distribution of wealth? I think potentially there could. And I think they might come in handy for certain things.
Well, Eric, thank you for joining me to discuss your book and the campaign, and also all of these options that are available to us really already. I was going to say on the horizon, but they're already here. It's just making use of them. Because one of the things that's always in the back of my mind, and you and I talked about this before, was that I kind of like being able to turn lights on and having civilization kind of as it exists. I'm okay if I have to make changes because, well, I'm not already involved in the consumer culture, but I may not have certain things available all the time or whatnot, but that life as it is kind of exists in perpetuity, that idea of a permanent civilization, or that if we have to make a move, that it occurs over time and isn't a radical or dramatic shift. And everything that you presented today, again, feeds that side of me that is not fearful, that is not scarcity driven, but thinks that we have abundance in the world, and that we really can make a difference without having to go back to like a hunter-gatherer society, or have to turn to people and say, you know, I'm an American, I got all of these privileges, I'm sorry you can't because the world has changed, but that we can give everybody else a hand up in this process and build a better world as a result of it.
Well, I'm really glad you see it that way. That's the way I feel, too. I like Civilization. I think there's a lot of things about it that are magnificent and unprecedented and should be celebrated and preserved. And certainly there's a ton of things about our civilization that are terrible for people and the planet and need to be totally transformed. It's been really fun learning about some of these other categories beyond food and just thinking, I think we can do this. I think we can do that. I think these perennial industrial crops could be grown in polycultures with integrated livestock and food production and be sort of part of the basis of life in a truly democratic and ecological global society, as they also are sequestering carbon and helping us address the climate crisis. And that to me is really about taking permaculture beyond the scale of the garden, because you're not going to grow, you know, rubber or fiber in your garden. Really, those are more things that have to be done at a community scale. And a lot of permaculture has been focused on what you can do in your backyard. And I love that. But I think we can't shy away from looking at this big issue as well.
And you're one of many voices that is adding to that broad scale conversation. And I thank you for it. Before we wrap things up, is there anything else that you'd like to add for the listeners?
Well, I'd love to hear from people who are experimenting with some of these crops. And I'd love to hear from people who are doing farm scale permaculture efforts anywhere in the world. I'm always really fascinated to hear about that. And I'm looking for a bunch of photos for this book of perennial crops and perennial farming systems. And I'd love to give photo credits and free copies of the book to people who are able to provide photos.
And would the best place for them to find you be through your website?
Yeah, that would be perennialsolutions.org is the place to find that. And I'll also be posting. I've been posting a lot of stuff there on my blog, and I'll continue to post things from there. Folks who actually make a contribution to Kickstarter will get sort of super duper access to the book as it's coming along. But everybody will get access to some things. I'll be posting some things as we go just to keep people in the loop and to keep this strategy part of the conversation. My real goal with this book is that, you know, when people talk about dealing with climate change now, clean energy is just one of the things people talk about. And I think that perennial agriculture needs to be right up there with clean energy as one of the things that just gets talked about.
Thank you, Eric, for taking this time to join me, that we were able to put this together on short notice and do this interview. I'm thankful to hear about the work that you're doing and the possibilities that the future holds for you, me, the world, perennial agriculture, and all these beautiful things that make the world a nicer place for all of us.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for all you do to bring permaculture to the masses.
And that was Eric Tonesmeyer. His Kickstarter campaign runs until the end of April 2013. At this point, he's not quite halfway to his goal, but making steady climbs, including my own donation to his cause. You'll find a link in the show notes at thepermaculturepodcast.com. Or by going to Kickstarter.com and searching for Eric Tonesmeyer. He and I did get a little geeky on the industrial perennial possibilities, but I keep turning over all those yields, many of which I didn't know about. Milkweed, which grows readily here in central Pennsylvania, is of particular interest. What other creative or novel solutions exist that we haven't begun to consider yet? What ways have you thought of to make a difference with permaculture that's new to you? I'd love to hear about it. Email me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or call the voicemail line, 717-827-6266. Next up is an audio article recorded by a listener and friend to the show, Andy Russell of Autonomy Acres. That piece is entitled, All Roads Lead to Permaculture. It is about his journey to permaculture. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.